This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
Hey all, this is Eric Christensen, pharmacist, host of the Real Life Pharmacology Podcast. Hope you're enjoying the show overall. If you're listening for the first time, hopefully you can get some value out of this podcast, whether you're preparing for real life or whether you're preparing for pharmacology exams or board exams. So with that, let's get into the podcast. We're going to cover rivaroxaban today. The brand name of that medication is Xarelto, and this is an anticoagulant type medication. This is one of the more common, newer oral anticoagulants. Rivaroxaban and apixaban, which I have done a podcast about, are probably the two most commonly used new oral anticoagulants that I see. And actually, there was a recent update with AHA, ACC, and HRS in their guidelines, and NOACs are now preferred. So those are the novel oral anticoagulants. Rivaroxaban and apixaban, as well as a couple others too that aren't used quite as often. But these drugs are now preferred over warfarin in the majority of situations in atrial fibrillation when we're trying to prevent stroke. There's a couple exceptions like mitral stenosis, as well as potentially artificial valves as well. But overall, in the majority of cases, these drugs are now preferred. So that's an interesting update there. And how these drugs work, or at least how rivaroxaban works, is it prevents those clots by inhibiting factor 10A. So this is an important factor that's within the clotting cascade and formation of clots. So factor 10A is required for the conversion of prothrombin to thrombin. And thrombin ultimately activates platelets and forms fibrin, which is essential for clot formation. So by preventing, by inhibiting factor 10A, ultimately we prevent the formation of blood clots. Now, from an adverse effect profile characteristic, obviously anytime we're going to inhibit the formation of clots, we're going to put our patients at risk for bleeding if the blood gets too thin. So that's always the risk with any type of anticoagulant. Both can be very serious consequences if we're undertreated, inadequately treated for stroke prevention. A stroke is a very serious consequence. If we overtreat or the patient doesn't tolerate the medication, that risk for bleed can be very substantial and risky as well. So we always have to weigh those clinical benefits versus some of those clinical risks. I did want to talk about dosing a little bit specifically with rivaroxaban. In non-valvular AFib, typical dose is 20 milligrams once a day. Now, in my mind, this is definitely advantageous over apixaban in that you only have to give it once a day. I know from working with patients that you start giving patients more and more medications to take throughout the day, that risk of them not complying or adhering to what we want them to do tends to go up. So apixaban is twice a day, and rivaroxaban is once a day. But that, you know, doesn't tell the full story. There's a few other reasons why I like apixaban as well, too. With the single once daily dosing, that definitely is an advantage over apixaban there. Now, in DVT-PE treatment, that's a little bit different dosing, and we actually use twice a day dosing there for a period of time. So it's typically 15 milligrams twice a day, and that's for 21 days. And then it's 20 milligrams once a day thereafter. And again, this can alter based upon clinical decision making and clinical factors, but that's kind of the usual standard dosing. And one at least advantage in my mind of apixaban over rivaroxaban is the clarity on the dosing. So interestingly, in non-valvular AFib with rivaroxaban, standard dose is 20 milligrams once a day. If creatinine clearance is 15 to 50 mils, it's 15 milligrams once a day. But they do leave this caveat open where you may consider reduction in moderate to severe CKD. So it's kind of a little bit gray. And then kind of to muddy the waters, in DVT and in use for PE, if creatinine clearance is less than 30, it's generally recommended to avoid use. So, 15 to 50 mils, we can maybe do a reduced dose in atrial fibrillation, and less than 30 with DVT-PE, a package insert at least says to generally avoid use of this medication. So, that kind of gives me a little bit of reservation and pause in patients that, maybe fluctuate a little bit with their kidney function and that type of thing. So kind of a tough, thing to figure out, know exactly what's right to do. I'm optimistic over time that there's probably going to be more evidence and more studies to kind of tease this out a little bit as far as that kidney function and exact doses that we should be using. But again, apixaban tends to spell that out a little bit better as far as the dosing. And I believe I went through that dosing on previous podcasts, so I'm not going to do that with apixaban today. But I did want to cover dosing a little bit there because I do think it is important to monitor that kidney function, pay attention, and obviously clinically monitor your patients as well for risk of bleed and or risk of stroke there as well. Adverse effects, I mentioned the anemia. As far as other adverse effects, personally, I haven't seen a lot. I remember one patient that had some fatigue and dizziness and things of that nature, and they actually weren't anemic. They felt it was from the medication, and that patient was switched off of that. But again, very, very rare and seldom have I seen too many side effects other than that bleed risk at this point. Like I said, if you do have a patient that is experiencing signs and symptoms of anemia, dizziness, fatigue, tiredness, they want to sleep all day, that type of thing, they look pale in color, definitely, we've got to monitor that CBC, make sure their hemoglobin isn't falling, they aren't losing blood and stool or wherever. So definitely keep tabs on that as patients are on therapy. One other thing I wanted to talk about with these agents is transition. This is a question that's come up definitely in my clinical practice before, is how do we transition, patient from warfarin to a newer agent, or, from enoxaparin to rivaroxaban, and so on and so forth. So I wanted to cover a couple of those topics here. So low molecular weight heparin, enoxaparin is by far the most common one used there. To rivaroxaban, in most cases, just giving the dose on the usual scheduled dose, so within 2 hours prior to the next scheduled dose of enoxaparin, that patient is going to be covered. So you really don't miss a beat, you don't double up, you just kind of keep giving that dose kind of in their usual dosing schedule with at least 2 hours prior to the next scheduled dose there of when they were going to get their next dose of enoxaparin. One other one I wanted to touch on was if you're transitioning a patient from warfarin to rivaroxaban, which may happen now more and more, given those newer guidelines I mentioned earlier in the podcast. If we've got a patient with an INR less than 3, then we stop warfarin and start that rivaroxaban. So that is U.S. Guidelines package insert. Canadian package insert says less than or equal to 2.5 INR. Then we stop the rivaroxaban and stop the warfarin and start in with the rivaroxaban there. Now, if you've got a patient there may be some clinical judgment here. If you've got a patient at super high risk of bleed, you know, you maybe wouldn't want their INR at 2.9, let's say, or very close to 3 before starting that dose of rivaroxaban. So you might err on the side of caution, allow that INR to get a little bit lower, maybe closer to 2. But again, you know, that's kind of a clinical judgment thing, looking at the patient, how they're doing, and maybe what their bleed risk is. So just wanted to cover a few of those little quirks and pearls with rivaroxaban and, you know, how to transition those patients on and or off the drug in a couple situations there. Let's take a quick break from our sponsor, MedEd101.com. We've got a great list of resources for practicing clinicians, pharmacists, nurses, good case books with case studies, things of that nature. All those resources, as well as for board exams like pharmacotherapy and geriatrics and ambulatory care, NAPLEX as well. All those resources are kept at meded101.com/store, and it's a great way to support the podcast if you're willing and able to do that as well. So meded101.com/store, you can go check out all those resources. Let's finish up here on drug interactions. One of the big advantages of these newer agents is there's less potential for diet and drug interactions than with warfarin. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't any drug interactions. We have to pay attention with these agents, and I'm going to give you some examples of meds that we really need to pay attention to. And again, when I lay out some of these drug interactions, these are things that I think are highly, highly important I've seen potentially in clinical practice come to an issue or present an issue there. So with that said, the list is definitely not all-inclusive. I would strongly encourage you to look some of these things up as you decide to start a patient on a new medication who's on some of these anticoagulants, and or as you're changing doses and changing things with a patient's medication regimen. So without further ado, avoiding use of rivaroxaban is recommended in patients on dual P-glycoprotein inhibitors and CYP3A4 inhibitors. So a few examples here, and these drugs aren't used crazy often, but just wanted to provide you a few examples. Ketoconazole, itraconazole, ritonavir are a few examples of those agents, and that is recommended to absolutely avoid using those agents with rivaroxaban. 3A4 inducers is another class there. Carbamazepine, I do see that drug used occasionally, whether it's, you know, trigeminal neuralgia, occasionally for seizures, maybe a rare case of bipolar disorder. We've got to look out for that because these inducers will actually lower concentrations of the rivaroxaban and potentially lead you down the path of treatment failure, increasing the risk of stroke by not having adequate concentrations there. So carbamazepine, rifampin, antibiotic that's used occasionally, not terribly often. St. John's Wort's, something I have seen patients try for depression, an over-the-counter supplement. So definitely strongly educate your patients about that one if they're ever considering taking over-the-counters. A couple other things to think about, or that I definitely think about, is erythromycin, clarithromycin. These are CYP3A4 inhibitors. They have been shown to potentially increase concentrations of rivaroxaban. So again, may lead to a situation where we're at higher risk of bleed. NSAIDs, they can, you know, inhibit those platelets. They can cause issues there, potentiating the effect of a GI bleed. So definitely we need to look out for that. I strongly encourage patients, to avoid these medications over the counter. Antiplatelet medications, so we got clopidogrel and aspirin. There has been some updates on guidelines in patients who have recently had a heart attack and a stent, and they also have atrial fibrillation. So you might want to go take a peek at that if you're a prescriber. And or clinical pharmacists that may need to be aware of that. I'm not going to go through that today. So definitely those drugs that can increase the risk of bleed, we've got to keep tabs on that. Those antiplatelets and NSAIDs are commonly used, and we need to pay attention to that. One other one I did want to mention, estrogen therapy. So patients with hot flashes, menopausal type symptoms that may be on estrogen therapy, remember they can increase the risk of blood clots and may kind of oppose the effects of some of these newer oral anticoagulants like rivaroxaban. So I think that's going to wrap it up for today. Thanks so much for listening. If you love the podcast, get some pearls, some clinical info out of it. I'm greatly appreciated if you'd leave a review, a rating on iTunes or wherever you're listening. That's certainly appreciated. If you have the opportunity, go support the podcast, meded101.com/store. You can see all those resources there, see if anything fits with what you're wanting to look at and learn there. So with that, I'm going to sign off. Thanks so much for listening. All the kind words greatly appreciated, and emails appreciated as well. We do have that free giveaway as well at reallifepharmacology.com. Top 200 study guide, 31-page PDF, where I highlight really important things with each drug in that study guide. Great resource for students, young professionals that may be taking board exams at any time in the near future, or pharmacology classes, of course. Signing off, thanks again. Eric Christensen, pharmacist. You can track me down at LinkedIn as well. Have a great rest of your day.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the Star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.